the bad Christian, or sermons on the seven deadly sins and the different sins against God and our neighbor which flow therefrom. But Father Francis Hunold, translated from the original German edition of Cologne, 1740, by Father J. Allen. Imprimatur, Martyr, Bishop James D. Ricard, copyright 1887. On the unaccountable folly of those who injure their health by excessive drinking. Priest on the third Sunday in Lent. When a strong man armed keepeth his court, those things are in peace which he possesseth. St. Luke chapter 11, verse 21. The fasts of Christians, says St. Ambrose, are our fortresses and bulwarks with which we defend ourselves from the attacks of our hellish foes and keep our souls in peace. We have already seen that, my dear brethren, as far as fasting and abstinence in food especially are concerned. But as fasting is useful, nay, even necessary to all in order to restrain gluttony in food, and so, in my opinion, temperance in the matter of drink is even more necessary to most people in order to avoid excess in that respect. Because excess in drink is more fruitful of evil than excess in eating. But I am afraid, at the very outset, that I will do little good by speaking of this matter. So very many of you are accustomed to excessive drinking that no amount of preaching will help you to overcome it. Therefore, as there is no use in asking you to abstain from drink, I will not do so. The one thing I will ask, and you will not, I hope, refuse me, and that is that none of you will drink more than he is able. But what a strange thing to say, you will think. Whoever drank more than he was able to drink? From an act, we may well conclude its possibility, as philosophers say. I drink, therefore I can drink. Ah, my dear brethren, would to God that the conclusion were always true in the right sense. How many of those who are addicted to excessive drinking, nay, almost all of them without exception, drink more than they can? That is, more than their health can bear, more than their income can bear, more than their honor and good name can bear, more than their soul's salvation and the divine law can bear. Whatever way we look at it, we must acknowledge that they are guilty of great folly and wickedness. Today I will confine myself to the first point, and I say, what an unaccountable folly it is to drink more than one's health can bear, as most people do. Such is the whole subject of today's sermon. Oh my God, forgive me for using such an apparently merely natural argument in explaining thy holy word. Yet I should rejoice at having done much for thy honor and glory if, even by such an argument as that, I succeeded in converting a single soul from the habit of excessive drinking, and thus saving him from the many evils that follow from it. Thou, O Lord, art the ruler of hearts. Effect this by thy grace, which we beg of thee through the intercession of Mary and of the holy angels guardian. Those women who are present, and who think that this subject does not apply to them, can profit by it with regard to the refreshments they indulge in at morning and midday when paying or receiving visits, by which they sometimes injure their health, interfere with their housekeeping, and even ruin their souls. Still, there are also drunken women to be found. What a shame! Of all the natural gifts that a man can possess on earth, there is none so precious, so useful, and agreeable as health and strength. And there is none God has so strictly commanded man to be careful of. There is nothing more useful, because what better am I for being rich and owning all the treasures of earth if I have lost my health and must lie ill in bed so that I cannot enjoy my riches? What would it avail me to be a great lord or king and to rule over many lands if I am weak and sickly and have to suffer pain day and night? What pleasure can I have in agreeable company and exquisite food and the delights of friendship or in the beauty of creatures if my health is gone and illness turns everything to bitterness for me? No, a piece of dry bread gives more pleasure and satisfaction to a poor man who is in good health than the daintiest food to a rich man who is ill and suffering. Nothing is more desirable in this mortal life than health, as is evident from the great care we take of it. How cautious we are about going into a house in which there is a person sick of a contagious disease. If it is not absolutely necessary to go there, we prefer to remain away. So great is our dread of breathing in an infected atmosphere and carrying the germs of disease away with us. How we dread exposing ourselves to the cold, damp air. That fear is sometimes so great that we dread going to church to hear a sermon or to assist at devotion, lest we should catch cold and be laid up. What a common thing it is to ask for leave to eat meat during Lent, for fear of injuring the health by eating fish. There is nothing more precious in the natural order than health, as we see at once when we begin to lose it. What mourning and lamentations, what wishing and desiring, and what is it all about? Oh, about the health we have lost and wish to regain. Money, silver, gold, and anything that can be called wealth is so dear to the man of the world that no journey is too long for him, no mountain too high, no sea too dangerous for him to cross in search of it. No watchings and labors are esteemed so difficult as long as he can add to his treasures by means of them. Lawsuits and contentions, hatred and enmity, rise amongst near relations solely on account of the difference between mine and thine. But when there is question of regaining health, although there may be only the faintest spark of hope, all these things are sacrificed without hesitation. If it takes 20 coppers of gold to buy the necessary medicines, they are sent to the apothecary at once. No matter how bitter the medicine is, the patient readily overcomes his dislike and swallows it. Bloodletting, thirst, burning, cutting, all are endured without a murmur, despite the pain they cause. And even he who inflicts those torments is paid for doing so, and thanked into the bargain. And why? Solely for the sake of regaining health. So much do men value that blessing. Besides, there is nothing which God has commanded us to look after more carefully than our health and strength. He has even renounced the right he has to our service when we cannot serve him without injuring our health. All the laws of his church are suspended when one cannot observe them, either on account of actual illness or through a reasonable fear of it. All Christians are bound under pain of grievous sin to hear Mass on Sundays and holy days. But if you are sick, although you might manage to get as far as the church, or if you are recovering from some illness, but still so weak that the cold air might bring on a relapse, then you may remain at home. The law does not bind you. Nay, you would even displease God and do wrong by going to Mass under the circumstances. On certain days, all Christians are bound under pain of grievous sin to abstain from flesh meat, and they who have attained the required age are obliged, moreover, to eat only one full meal in the day. But if you are sick and your health really requires it, you may eat whatever and as often as you please, you are not obliged to fast. The law does not bind you under those circumstances. I and all priests are obliged under pain of mortal sin to say the divine office every day. And in fact, they who have a benefice must make restitution for that day in which they have culpably omitted their office. But if I am ill, if my health is likely to suffer, if I would get a violent headache by reciting the office, I am not bound to do so. I may put my breviary away. God does not wish me to say it. My health has to be considered before His service. Even if I have made a vow to recite the office, I am not bound to keep it. In the same way, as theologians teach, those religious who make a vow never to eat meat are not bound to keep it in case of sickness when there is a necessity for eating meat in order to regain health. Nay, many maintain that there is an obligation under pain of sin to eat meat in such a case when it is required to prolong life, although that obligation can rarely be enforced on account of the difficulty of deciding with certainty that the use of meat is necessary. However that may be, there is no doubt that God has commanded us most strictly to preserve our health and strength. And yet, O precious health, so useful to man, so important in the sight of God, how many there are who recklessly ruin and destroy thee! By what? By frequent and excessive drinking. The life that is so precious, and that would not otherwise be readily exposed to danger by anyone, is deliberately and willfully shortened and brought to a premature end by drunkenness. I do not imagine that it will require much to prove that excessive drinking ruins the health and thereby shortens life. Holy Fathers and Doctors of the Church, you could not understand how it could be possible for one who is addicted to drinking too much to remain healthy for a long time. And therefore, you ask, with St. Basil, how can a body be healthy when it is filled with too much drink? And with St. Ambrose, you say, drunkenness is most injurious to the bodily health. Therefore, with Tertullian, you call drunkenness a premature old age and a sudden death. But I am not in need of your testimony. O sacred Scripture, thy words are infallible. What dost thou say? It goeth in pleasantly, I read in the book of Proverbs, but in the end it will bite like a snake and will spread abroad poison like a basilisk. By surfeiting many have perished, says the wise Ecclesiasticus, but he that is temperate shall prolong life. I appeal to reason itself and daily experience. Most, nay, nearly all diseases come from ill-digested humors in the stomach. These humors must necessarily arise frequently in a stomach that is constantly surcharged with wine and other strong drinks, which are of their nature apt to heat the blood and to render the work of digestion very difficult and tedious. Hence the dumb beast that will not drink unless it is thirsty, and poor people who are not accustomed to excess in this particular are not subject to nearly so many diseases as those who are wont to gratify their sensuality in every occasion. How must it then be with those who drink to excess and even intoxicate themselves every day? All sorts of fevers, diseases of the chest and lungs, dropsy, consumption, palsy, apoplexy, gout, trembling of the limbs, and impurity of the blood, although they may in some cases have a different origin, are mostly the effects of excessive eating and drinking, and temperate people are not apt to be subject to them. Petrarch explains this in a poem. The gout, he says, and a spider once met in the street. The spider ran along quickly, but the gout, with its lame legs, had to hobble along on crutches. They asked each other where they were going. I, said the spider, am going out of town in despair. I cannot stop there any more. I used to live in the house of a rich man who was accustomed to sleep till midday in order to get rid of the effects of the wine he had drunk overnight. And every evening he would repeat his potations. So that I was in hopes that, since he was thus occupied the whole day, he would let me weave my web in peace. Unfortunately, he has such a number of servants that every morning, when their master is asleep, they go around with brooms and sweep away every vestige of my work they find, so that I am not even sure of my life. Therefore, I have to seek another home. It's the very same thing with me, said the gout. I tried to live with a poor laboring man, but like you, I fared badly. Bread and water at noon, bread and water in the evening, bread and water from one week's end to the other, and hard work besides. I assure you, I nearly died of hunger and thirst, and had to leave. Very good, then, said the spider. I know what we can do. Let us change. Do you go to the rich man, who will give you enough to eat and drink every day, and I will find peace with your former host. And they acted on this advice. Therefore, concludes the poet, the gout and similar maladies are at home with those who pass their days in eating and drinking to excess, and thus shorten their lives. They themselves acknowledge this to be the case. They often complain of being indisposed. Sometimes they have a headache, and other times they complain of the stomach, or the loss of appetite. There is always something wrong with them, and no wonder. If you keep a kettle always on the boil, you must not be surprised to see steam coming from it. The providence of God has wisely ordained that excessive drinking should be its own punishment, and should cause all those evils to those who are addicted to it, in order that, if they are still capable of using their reason and following its dictates, they may be deterred from indulging in that evil habit. Yet, how many there are who are utterly uninfluenced by this consideration? If we drink too much, they say, what else can we expect but to suffer for it? And so they go on drinking down, disease after disease, if not at once, at least little by little. Father Dexlarius writes in his Prodromus that he once saw in a certain churchyard in Germany two graves that had the same inscription. One was that of an old man, and over it were written the words, Et mortis est, and he died. Then it was that of a young man who died in the bloom of youth. It had the same inscription as the first, but there was a note of interrogation placed after it, so that it read, Et mortis est, and did he die? In my opinion, they might have left out the note of interrogation, or have placed it in the inscription over the grave of the old man. For what happens often is not by any means astonishing or wonderful, and it is a well-known fact that more people die young than old. The astonishing thing is that they who are anxious to live long and to reach a ripe old age should not have patience to await the arrival of death, but must hurry it on and shorten their lives in their best years by excessive drinking. What an unaccountable folly that is, nay, how wicked it is. Food and drink are given to us by our bountiful Creator for the sole purpose of preserving our health and strength, and they are abused through intemperance and made the means of destroying health and shortening life. How will they who thus become their own murderers answer to God for what they have done? What is the difference between killing a man with one thrust of a dagger and taking his life by slow poison, when death is sure to follow in either case. Is it a lesser crime to drink oneself to death than to commit suicide by drowning? Edward IV, King of England, had condemned his brother George, Duke of Clarence, to death. The latter, when he heard the sentence, begged as a last favor that he might be put to death by being drowned in a butt of Malmsey wine. His request was granted. He was put into a large butt filled with his favorite drink and was drowned therein. What an extraordinary choice he made! Did he lose his life the less in that way than if he had been executed in the ordinary manner? Still, death was not voluntary on his part. He was put into the wine by force and kept there until he lost his life. How great, then, is the malice of those who will not wait until the sentence of death is passed upon them by God, who is the master of our lives, but of their own free will drown themselves in wine, that is, drink to such excess that a premature death must necessarily follow. Worldly-minded people sometimes accuse poor religious of cruelty because they shorten their lives by all kinds of austerities, by fasting and disciplines, by watchings and prayers. But it is one thing to mortify oneself and to keep the flesh in subjection to the spirit for the love of God, and another to pamper the body and to make the spirit subject to it. And if the religious commits a sin, if he must render an account to God for having injured his health and shortened his life by his indiscreet austerities, what kind of a sin is he guilty of, and what sort of an account will he have to render, who ruins his health and destroys his life by excessive drinking, solely for the purpose of gratifying his passions? Further, what blindness is it to drink more than one's health can bear? Tell me, why do you drink so much? Is it not to satisfy the sense of taste? But do you not see that by your excesses you are lessening the pleasures that this sense is capable of feeling, that you are ruining your head and stomach, and that you will have little pleasure left when your health is gone? Put a cask of wine in the public marketplace, and let it be well guarded by strong men armed with good cudgels. Let every one who wishes drink of it to his heart's content, but on condition that after every glass he must get a good drubbing with the cudgel. I think you would not find many anxious to drink on such a condition as that. Yet it is exactly the case of the drunkard, who has to pay for his excesses by disordered head and stomach. How can one then continue in such folly? The servant, says St. Basil, runs when he sees his master coming after him with a stick, but you will not run away from wine, although it gives you many a knock on the head. What greater folly can there be? And here I cannot refrain from expressing my astonishment at an extraordinary custom prevalent in Germany. A man invites a number of friends to a feast and compels them to drink more than they are able to bear. And if any one of them refuses to do so, they immediately draw down upon him the displeasure and ridicule of the others, so that the unfortunate people are obliged to drink until they incur all the disagreeable consequences of perfect sobriety. There is no respite granted. All must drink till they can drink no more. I must say that I am quite at a loss to understand this. Can you give me any intelligible reason for it? Why do you invite your friends? Is it not to give them pleasure, to show your esteem for them? But how can it please them to be compelled to drink against their will and to fill themselves up with wine until they become sick? What sort of friendship is that which shows itself by forcing a man to get drunk and taking from him the most precious natural good he has, namely, his health? You invite your friend to a feast, says St. Ambrose, and then make him take away his life. You ask him to sit at your table and then force him to drink as if your greatest wish were to see him carried off to his grave. You offer him the best wine you have, but in such excess that you convert it into a virulent poison which will destroy body and soul. You call him your dearest friend and wish him many happy years as you drink his health, and at the same time, you sow in him the seeds of a premature death. This is called drinking his health? He who compels another to drink more than is good for him, says St. Augustine, does him more harm than if he were to wound him with a sword, for he thus compels him to lose the health of body and soul. What thanks do you expect from your friend next morning when he awakens with a splitting headache for which he knows you are to blame? How can you expect him to be grateful to you when you have made him sick by dint of drinking his health? In olden times there was a law in Lombardy which forbade the drinking of healths, anno socii nequis bibat. The reason of that law, as Paulus Diaconus writes, was the sudden death of four people at once. These four were drinking together, and they agreed that, as a mark of friendship, each one should drink as many glasses as his neighbor was years old. They were all pretty well advanced in age, and of course they had to drink a great many glasses. They all held out until they had drunk the prescribed amount, but with the last glass, the four of them drank in death, for they died that very day. A fine way, that, of showing friendship, whereby a man takes away his own life along with that of his friend. In former times, there was a laudable custom in Germany of offering what one was about to drink to another, that he might bless it with the words, "I offer it to you," whereupon the other answered, "God bless it for you." How different that from the present custom which compels a man to drink to intoxication! Would it not be a thousand times, I will not say more edifying in Christian light, but more courteous, pleasant, and agreeable, to allow everyone full liberty as regards drinking, so that no one need drink more than he cares for? In the book of Esther, we read of the great feast of King Ahasuerus, wine also in abundance and of the best was presented, as was worthy of the king's magnificence. Neither was there any one to compel them to drink that were not willing, but as the king had appointed, who set over every table one of his nobles, that every man might take what he would. Was not that a better way of enjoying one's self at a feast? In that manner, every one could please himself and show friendship and love to his neighbor. But, as for the other custom, if a man compels me to drink more than I care for, I am not inclined to think much of his friendship. Finally, how great the folly of those who allow themselves to be persuaded into drinking more than they can bear, to their own great discomfort, and to the detriment of the health that is so precious to themselves and to their families. "Oh," they say, "I must do as others do. I do not wish to be the first to interfere with an established custom. I would be ashamed to acknowledge that I could not drink any more, and if I did so, I should be laughed at." But what a senseless excuse that is! Let fools laugh, if they will. You have no reason to be ashamed of acting wisely. Place a piece of iron of some 1,000 pounds weight on your servant's back, and tell him to carry it, and when he finds it too heavy, and says, "Sir, I am not able to carry it," laugh at him. Tell him it is a shame for him to be so weak, and see whether your laughing will make him any stronger. No, he still gives you the same answer. He is still unable to carry the heavy weight. And is that any shame for him? Why then should you be ashamed if you are unable or unwilling to drink as much as others? If so, it is an honor which belongs also to a large wine cask, which holds more than a smaller one. If it were not so large, it would have nothing to boast about more than the smaller one. It is, as Demosthenes says, an honor that a sponge might claim, because it can absorb a great deal of water. But, they answer, I cannot refuse to drink the health of my friend, of my employer, etc., and I must drink it in a brimming bumper in order to show my respect for them. What a ridiculous thing! How foolish the customs of the world are! Tell me, what good do you do your friend thereby? What honor or respect do you show your master by pouring wine down your throat? How does it help his health if you injure yours by drinking more than you can bear? Prince Radoswell relates that in his pilgrimage to Jerusalem, a Turk holding a knife in his hand and with the upper part of his body bare and covered with cuts and bleeding wounds met him and offered to cut himself with a knife in honor of the Roman emperor for one Turkish penny. The prince took pity on the poor barbarian and gave him a piece of money, telling him that he need not perform the act of savagery, as it would do no good to the emperor. But when the foolish man got the money, he persisted in showing his respect for the emperor by cutting and hacking at himself until he was covered with blood. Who would not be shocked at such madness, my dear brethren? And yet, the man was only a heathen and a barbarian. Far greater is the madness of a Christian, born and bred under the mild law of Jesus Christ, who, to show honor to a mere mortal, fills himself to excess with wine, and so inflicts a grievous wound on both body and soul, thereby showing, in reality, as little honor to the other as a Turk showed the emperor by mangling his body. Nay, it very often happens that the wine thus swallowed in honor of another has to be rejected again, as the stomach cannot digest it. A nice way indeed of showing respect, if instead of drinking to excess, one prayed for one's friends or gave the superfluous wine to the poor, much more good would be done for their souls. Again, if it were the custom to eat to a person's health, as it is the custom to drink to it, and I do not see any reason for one more than for the other, would you show great respect for a man eating too much in his honor? Suppose that after you have eaten enough, a man were to bring you a large plate full of porridge and tell you that you have to eat it up in honor of some great man. Would you do it, think you? I do not believe you would be so foolish. And if the other tried to compel you, you would say at once, I am not able. Why then do you not say so when you are asked to drink more than you can bear? No reasonable man will be offended at your refusing to eat more than you are able, nor can anyone find cause for offense if you do not drink what you know is not good for you. Father Faber tells us of a certain Pole who acted in this manner. This Pole was once invited to a German feast, at which, according to custom, one health after another was drunk. He drank the health as well as he could, until at last he began to think, if it goes on like this all the evening, what will be the end of it? Gentlemen, he cried out, I beg of you to excuse me. I cannot drink any more. Hereupon, one of the guests filled a large glass with wine and offered it to him, saying that he should drink it to the health of a certain prince in whose service he was. The Pole, finding no other way out of the difficulty, took up an enormous cheese and holding it out to the other said, There, eat that to my prince's health. But what do you mean? Answered the other. I am not a wolf to be able to eat so much. Neither am I an ox, replied the Pole, so that I cannot drink as much as you ask me. And why should you try to force me to drink to my prince's health when you refuse to eat to his health?" A clever and sensible answer, truly. "Do not forget it, you who are likely to have occasion to profit by it. If ever an attempt is made to compel you to drink, relate at once what you heard in the sermon about the pole. Think and say, 'You may bring me as much as you like. I will not drink more than is good for me. My health and strength are too precious and useful to be thrown away in that unchristian fashion and against my will, too.' I often allege my health as an excuse when the law of the church obliges me to fast, when the bell rings for Mass on a cold winter's morning, or when devotions are held in the church at such an early hour that I fear to injure my health by going. Why, then, should not the same excuse avail me when there is question not of devotion or of the divine service, but of being compelled to indulge in drunkenness and intemperance contrary to the law of God? Therefore, I will in the future act on that, and no sensible man can think the worse of me for so doing. Rather will I, as St. Augustine advises me, be a martyr of temperance, although I thus incur the ridicule of foolish men, than ruin my health and become a torment to myself through a foolish desire of excelling others in drunken excess. Thus I shall preserve not only the health of my body, but also that of my mortal soul. Thus I shall avoid much evil, and what should be of much greater importance to me, I shall observe thy law, O God, and fulfill thy will. Grant me thy grace to keep this resolution. Amen."